Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you're listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. I'm George Dvorsky, podcasting to you today on Monday, February the 5th, 2007. I've got several things we're going to discuss today. I'm going to start off describing the case in British Columbia involving the family of Jehovah Witnesses who had their babies seized so that they could be given blood transfusions. I'm going to be discussing ethical eating and ethical food choices, some things to consider the next time you head to the grocery store. And I'll close the show with an article about how pop art is becoming proletarianized, or how technology will enable anyone to play guitar like Eddie Van Halen. Well, before we get started, though, I'm going to talk about just some news bits. I'm sure many of you have heard about the recent plight by Keith Henson, who's the critic of Scientology. He's currently sitting in a jail cell, very desperately trying not to be extradited to California, where he fears for his life. Keith Henson was in 2001 charged with a misdemeanor in California. The charge was obstructing a religion, which is against the law in California. You kind of quote unquote obstruct a religion. I guess it violates freedom of speech laws. And rather than face a jail term, which Henson was quite terrified of doing because he was fearing for his life after receiving numerous death threats, he made his way to Canada, where he was pretty much in hiding until 2005. He lost his bid for asylum, and he went back to the U.S., and the law eventually caught up with him on Saturday when he was pulled over while driving his wife's car, and he is now sitting in a jail cell in Arizona, and it'll be interesting to see what will happen over the next few weeks and months and what's going to happen to Keith. And this is a personal issue for me because I'm friends with Keith and with his wife, Arel. I got to know them when they were here in the Toronto area and became quite fond of them, and I miss them dearly since they left over a year ago. And I'm following this case quite closely as a result, and my thoughts are constantly drifting over to this issue over there. I feel quite helpless, but I'm sure we all do. But if you feel that there's something you would like to do, head on over to the Extropy Institute, because they've set up an area where you can donate. One thing you need to understand is this family is they have no money whatsoever. They've been made completely bankrupt by this episode, and they're in desperate need of any kind of help right now. So if you would be kind enough to give them anything at this point would be better than nothing. And the second note, I just want to note that I'm fasting this week. I do this on occasion. Sometimes I do it because it's kind of scheduled. I try to fast at least four times a year. I do it seasonally. And other times I fast when I feel that my eating habits are starting to get out of whack and I'm starting to lose perspective on eating. So I'll just briefly talk about that. What I do is it's a five-day fast. Some would refer to it as a cleanse. I start on the Monday, and it'll end on the Friday. And Monday and Tuesday, I do eat, but I only eat raw fruits and vegetables and fruit juices. I was also drinking some green tea today, which is probably not a true fast then, because there is minute quantities of caffeine in the green tea. Because again, the idea here is to eliminate a lot of the foods that you would normally eat on a regular basis. So I'm completely off coffee today, which is a big deal for me. I'm a big coffee drinker. I tend to have at least two cups a day. So I'm feeling today, for example, the effects of caffeine withdrawal, which usually translates into a massive headache, which I'm thankfully not experiencing today, and fatigue, which I am experiencing today. But what I know from experience is that the first day is most definitely the hardest day of the fast. It's unintuitively as unintuitive as that might seem. And over the course of the fast, you feel better and better, and you have more energy, and there's a very good reason for this. Again, I'll just briefly describe the fast again. So Monday, Tuesday, raw fruits and vegetables. On Wednesday and Thursday, I will only be drinking fruit juices, things like basically smoothies. So you get these really rich and creamy smoothies. So there, you do still get to have some nourishment at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But Friday, that's the hard day. Friday, absolutely nothing except glasses of water. And then you can break the fast on the Saturday morning. And again, you have to do that very gently. You'll want to start the morning off with a banana and maybe just a glass of water. What you can do is in the water, maybe put a bit of honey, some salt, and some cayenne, and just eat that. You get your juices will get flowing again, and by lunchtime you can start to eat normally. And again, the reasons for doing this, like I mentioned earlier, it gives me perspective on my eating habits. You very quickly, when you're fasting, realize that you just can't always grab for that snack that's over there, or run to the fridge and partake in some food there and this and that. So the habitual nature of eating really comes to the fore, and you're really kind of forced to confront just how mindless the whole eating experience can often be. So by the end of the week, I'll have what I know, and I know this from experience, I'll have gained a certain degree amount of perspective on my eating habits. But I also do it for aesthetic reasons. For me, it's a self-discipline. I'm always kind of pushing myself in these sorts of regards. And this is, a strength test. And again, you're strengthening that muscle that's otherwise known as discipline. So it's a kind of a test for me that way. And I like to do that fairly regularly. And I also do it for health reasons. I think it's good to give the body a bit of a break, and kind of there is this cleansing aspect to it. And I'm not sure a whole lot of the science behind it, but there's the idea that if you stop eating a lot of the foods that you normally eat, particularly a lot of the processed garbage that's out there, your body goes through what's called a cleansing, and the releasing of the toxins, which is another reason why in the first couple of days you feel kind of lousy, because your body is suddenly flooded with all that gunk that's been stuck in your body for quite some time. And as well, because your body is getting ready for starvation mode, because your body thinks that when you start to fast, your body is preparing for the worst. It thinks, uh-oh, here we go, into a long starvation mode. So what it does is it releases your body is metabolizing, it starts to release and give you more energy, which is why typically at the midpoint of a fast, you have a heightened amount of energy. I feel great. And what also accompanies that is great mental clarity and acuity. You feel sharp, your mind is sharp, you're alert, your senses are heightened, particularly your senses of smell and hearing, I find. And again, by Friday, though, you could eat. You can definitely start to think to yourself, yeah, I can really start to look forward to Saturday and having some real food. And that's all part of the process. And then I know that I'll be able to ride this for a while and, again, have a good perspective on my eating habits. So that's just some personal news. Again, back to the Keith Henson issue. Please go to the Extropy Institute and drop a couple of dollars into there and help out this family who could really use some help right now. All right, so let's get on to the show, and I'm going to talk about these items. So let's get started. A month ago, Canada's first ever sextuplets were born, and that was in and of itself big news. Canada never had a family produce six kids before. There's the famous Dionne quintuplets, of course, but not six. And what I didn't realize at the time was that the news was going to get even bigger than that. The babies, four boys and two girls, were delivered after only 25 to 26 weeks of gestation. One was born naturally, and the rest were born via C-section. And each weighed less than 2 pounds each. So they were preemies. They were smaller than an adult hand, and they were immediately placed in intensive care where they were listed under fair condition. Their vital signs, they were stable and within normal limits, but because they were preemies, they were, and because of the severity of the earliness of how they were born, they were initially given an 80% probability of surviving. The reason for this and the reason for the low rate is that preemies have underdeveloped organs and immune systems, which make them more vulnerable to infection. And in fact, one baby did die very soon after the birth, and a second one died in the following weeks. And so there were four babies left, each of them surviving and clinging to life. Now, it just so happens that these babies were born to Jehovah's Witnesses, and that's a Christian sect that forbids blood transfusions and organ transplants. It's not uncommon for preemies to need and to undergo blood transfusion. And the reason for this is that they tend to suffer from low hemoglobin, and they experience blood loss as a consequence of frequent blood tests. Instead, what JW parents do, and what these particular parents do, they insist on alternative measures, including commonsensical things like careful attention to minimal blood sampling. But there's also a different take on the clinical acceptance of lower hemoglobin levels, use of different kind of stimulants to produce red blood cells, and other medical procedures. Now, not satisfied, though, with these alternative therapies and concerned that the surviving infants weren't going to make it, the provincial government in British Columbia began to scramble and mobilize for more drastic action. On January the 29th, under the Child, Family, and Community Service Act, and with the support of the Supreme Court, the government took temporary custody of one infant to allow for what was deemed an essential blood transfusion. And on the next day, the Ministry of Children and Family Development, they asked the parents for permission to perform a blood transfusion on the second infant, but they got no answer. So they had no choice, and they took the second child into protective custody and was also given a blood transfusion. And in a statement from the father, he said he could not bear to be at the hospital when they were violating his little girl. And he complained that it was unfair of the ministry to label them as unfit because they, quote, choose alternative medical treatments to blood transfusions, end quote. Eventually, the third baby was taken to the hospital. It's unclear whether this baby actually had a blood transfusion, and the fourth was remained under the parents' guardianship. And the Vancouver parents are now in a legal battle with the province, claiming that the government violated their religious freedoms. And a couple of days ago, the government announced that they will do this again if they feel it is necessary. Now, this case, by the way, I'm very much in support of the government of British Columbia here. I think they totally did the right thing. And I'm going to kind of explain why I feel that's the case. In regards to the issue of religious freedoms, this is a really good example of why there needs to be a clear demarcation between what the church does and what the state does in the various roles. Religious injunctions, they often contribute to poor and ill-informed decisions. Obviously, they're unscientific. They're based on scripture. There's very little foundation from a medical perspective to always adhere to a religious injunctions. But the state, on the other hand, they must and they can remain impartial, and they can perform due diligence on these matters and on matters of religious consequence. And it's for similar reasons that I have also argued for the separation of church and bioethics, which hasn't really happened yet. It's kind of a subtle thing that a lot of bioethics panels and a lot of things that influence bioethics panels are very much religiously motivated. That's a topic for another show. The parents, who are very clearly happy to be parents and who claim to be looking out for their children's best interests, are refusing to allow treatment on what are really nonsensical grounds. These are scriptural or even aesthetic justifications, yuck factor justifications even, because Jehovah's Witnesses, they talk about the impurity of the blood and the mixing and matching of blood and how it's vile. And again, you have this real dichotomy between this real classical dichotomy in religion between the pure and the impure, or the sacred and the profane. These types of injunctions against these types of life, what are really life-saving interventions, they are arbitrary and negligent at best. And I use the word arbitrary because the mother utilized fertility treatments that assisted in her pregnancy, and which subsequently accounted for the sextuplets being born. So while it was okay to use fertility treatments, it's not okay to use blood transfusions. And again, there's no real kind of rhyme or reason to the various things that pop up in their minds and what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. Now, in our liberal democracies, the right to practice religion, it's largely a policy of tolerance. Citizens are given the benefit of the doubt in free societies to worship as they see fit. But it's a freedom that is endured so long as the social contract is maintained. You can't break the law and then later cry that your religious freedoms have been violated. It's for this very reason, for example, that Sharia law will not and cannot be introduced in Canada, despite pressure by some to do so. That idea died, thankfully, very quickly. The British Columbia government did what they needed to do. Moreover, it's their responsibility to intervene in cases such as these. And this is why we have governments in the first place. The parents make an extremely poor and dangerous decision on behalf of their children, and these kids were in no position to offer protest or to defend themselves. Which then leads to the next topic of parental obligations. Where do we draw the line? Is it merely life-saving interventions that need to be enforced? Will enhancement technologies change this situation? Like blood transfusions, future technologies will change expectations about what can and should be done. Access to genetic technologies, for example, may one day result in mandatory therapies that eliminate genetic disorders. And this practice may become so standard and accepted that failure to do so may eventually be considered abusive. And there is, of course, the further risk that if you're a child and you were born with a preventable condition, what's to prevent you from suing your parents for failing to intervene when you know they could have done so? Consequently, and this is somewhat of a prescription to prevent this from happening, what needs to happen is that the state will have to establish a minimum set of mandatory therapies. And creating such a list will not be easy, but again, not without precedent, because currently there's things like vaccinations, which are unquestioningly an enhancement type medical technology, because it does endow you with a greater than human capacity to fight off pathogens. Creating such a list will not be easy, though, but because there's forever going to be disagreement as to what constitutes a disorder and how you discern the line between therapy and enhancement. And this will become all the more complicated when traits that come about via enhancement start to normalize to the point where the absence of such endowments prevent an individual from partaking in society in the same way that the lack of an education and even things like illiteracy does today. No, these are not easy decisions. But, and I want to stress this, neither is the choice to become a parent. Prospective parents must realize that the decision to have children comes with a requisite set of obligations. It's not just a fleeting thing you decide, oh, I'm going to become a parent, and whatever happens, happens. No. They need to ensure, and this is becoming all the more crucial given the presence now of more and more sophisticated biotechnologies, that they need to ensure, as is most reasonably possible, that their children be given all the benefits that health technologies can bring, so that they may live healthy, full, and open-ended lives. This issue also brings to mind the right to decline treatment. The Jehovah's Witnesses' parents, they were acting on behalf of their infants. They claimed not only that their religious freedoms had been violated, but that they were unjustifiably prevented from using alternative therapies. There's a couple of things to consider here. First, with two babies already dead and another four clinging to life, the decision to seize the children and force blood transfusions was not made lightly. The doctors chose to err on the side of caution, as failure to act could have resulted in their deaths. Severe cases are not a time to experiment with alternative therapies. And moreover, aside from hurt religious sensibilities, the blood transfusions did not cause any harm. The second issue is more complex, because it deals with the not just the right of refusing treatment, but when you have an adult who makes the decision based on informed consent. Now, I support things like voluntary euthanasia, and I do also support alternative medicines. And I believe that citizens deserve the right to manage their health in the best way they see fit. And self-injury is a related issue, but it's one that falls outside the bounds of this particular post. Consequently, an adult Jehovah's Witness has the right to refuse a blood transfusion, even if it is a foolish decision. As for children, society is set up such that parents make critical decisions on their behalf until they reach the age of consent. And in this sense, children are a special class of citizens. They don't have the full spectrum of privileges and rights that adults have. For example, they cannot vote or drink alcohol. But at the same time, We give children special protections. The state, in conjunction with children, things like children's aid societies, they are within their bounds to take a child into protective custody when the parents have been declared unfit. Parents have the authority to make decisions for their kids by default, but that privilege can be taken away from them when necessary. In the case of the BC sextuplets, the decision to withhold treatment was tantamount to negligence and even abuse. Had the babies died as a consequence of insufficient treatment, the province would have been within their bounds to charge the parents with child abuse causing death and possibly even homicide. The rationale behind the parents' inaction makes no difference, whether it be instigated by religion, mental illness, or alcohol. Just some closing notes here. I am certain that the parents' decision to withhold treatment was an extremely difficult one and that this is a very trying time for them. It may take some time before they achieve any sense of normalcy again. They will have to deal with the fact that their children were given blood transfusions and move on. And I certainly hope that they will not look at their infants as being any less special. Moreover, I hope that their community will not shun them out like they have done to others in similar cases. I also hope that when all is said and done, that the parents will look back one day and be grateful that action was taken to save the lives of their children. During the past several years, I've paid increasing attention to my food choices in an effort to eat more healthily. Guided mostly by the sage advice of Dr. Andrew Weil, I've become very careful about the foods I put into my body. But lately, I've been just as concerned with my food choices as they pertain to ethical considerations as I've been with health issues. For example, while I am a vegetarian, I do like to eat eggs, preferably those that are omega-3 enriched. But I've always been uncomfortable with my choice, knowing that eggs tend to come from factory farms. I remember last year I had this moment when I realized that I have the option of buying eggs laid by free-range chickens. Clearly, my ethical eating habits have considerable room for improvement, and I'm getting there, and the options enabling me to eat more ethically are increasing all the time. When I think about my vegetarianism and my food purchasing habits, I focus on three distinct motivators: health, animal ethics, and the environment. Lately, however, the latter two considerations have been giving me great cause for concern, obliging me to reevaluate my eating habits even further. And I was interested to see last year when the book came out by Peter Singer and Jim Mason titled The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. Singer and Mason, they discuss such things as corporate deception, widespread waste, and desensitization to inhumane practices in the context of ethical food choices. The book's main thrust is that America's food industry seeks to keep Americans in the dark about the ethical components of their food choices. Needless to say, this is hardly an exclusively American phenomenon. What the authors are suggesting is that most people are either oblivious, ambivalent, or in complete denial about the negative effects of their eating habits, and the food industry is largely responsible for both creating and perpetuating these feelings of disconnect. Yet, Singer and Mason are not just decrying the state of the food industry, they are also trying to come up with solutions. As noted in a recent Salon article, some of these solutions are in tune with my own hopes for the future, including the growing of meat from brainless animals, or even such things as lab-grown meat. But they've also some more radical ideas, including the neuroengineering of animals to alter their instinctual tendencies. I'm a little bit unsure about this last idea, though. The suggestion that the psychologies of farm animals be adjusted to reduce their subjective sense of suffering is off-putting, mostly because it would do nothing to improve our relationship with animals, nor would it result in more humane farming practices. While I can understand why Singer and Mason would push for such an improvement, it's a real and hard fix after all, and real animals would suddenly be suffering a decreased degree than what they're doing now. And while I run the risk of posing a slippery slope argument, I think that such a strategy could open a Pandora's box of potential problems that could extend outward to other non-human animals and even humans themselves. Moreover, such a strategy would do nothing to alleviate the negative environmental impacts of factory farming. There is one individual, however, who is pushing for long-term sustainable farming and an increase in ethical food options. He is an evangelical Virginia farmer named Joel Salatin, and he believes that a revolution against industrial agriculture is just down the road. Similar to the hope that big energy will dissipate into smaller, localized, and sustainable versions, Salatin envisions the end of mega farms and supermarkets, which is a claim that quite obviously is going against the current trend. He argues on behalf of localized farming and refuses to ship anything out from his farm. He believes in relationship marketing and contends that eye-to-eye contact is necessary when a transaction is conducted between a farmer and a consumer. As quoted in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, he says, "Don't you find it odd that people will put more work into choosing their mechanic or house contractor than they will into choosing the person who grows their food?" What Salatin believes is happening is the rise of alternative agriculture, while the mainstream splitting into smaller and smaller groups of like-minded people. Pollan himself believes that there is more to food than just price and convenience. Rather, our relationship to food constitutes our most profound engagement with the natural world, he says. He sees the trip to the supermarket as a crime against the environment and oneself. In an Utney article about pollen, it noted that when people start to become personally invested in what they eat, they enter a kind of landscape and kind of community. When I think about these various perspectives and reflect on my own choices, I necessarily have to weigh the options. Being an informed consumer and someone who legitimately cares about animals and the environment is something that informs a big part of my decision making. But equally, I have to watch my budget and not inconvenience myself beyond what I deem to be acceptable. As the omnivorous Dalai Lama himself admits, most of us cannot live perfectly ethical lives, but we should strive to do the best we can and mete out as little harm as possible. Notice how jazz has suddenly become high art? Walk into any Starbucks and you're likely to hear Miles Davis pipe through the sound system as you guzzle your venti latte alongside your fellow sophisticates. It wasn't always this way, of course. Like all new art forms, jazz was once dismissed by a snobbish wave of the hand as being the cacophonous, subversive music of the working class. It's funny how art works. At first, it's rejected and regarded as a threat or antithetical version of the established and credible art forms. Then, after it gains popularity and becomes profitable, it becomes broadly accepted, refined, and institutionalized, like Miles Davis CDs for sale at your local Starbucks. Music in the 20th century has experienced a revolution of sorts, particularly Western pop music. Prior to Bob Dylan, vocalists were all virtuosic in ability. You had to sound like Nat King Cole to get noticed. Dylan, on the other hand, was the everyman singer. He mumbled into the microphone and sounded no better than the guy next door. But that was the revolution. By showing that good and profound music could be performed by just about anyone, Dylan cast popular music in a new light and gave it a new sense of relevancy for the masses. Music didn't have to be uber refined and stuffy. It could be out of tune, off tempo, even a little bit off the cuff and still have a strong aesthetic worth. Moreover, performance stars no longer had to be inaccessible and unrelatable prodigies. They could be regular folk, just like you and me. Soon after the Dylan phenomenon, garage bands and caterwauling vocalists started to come out of the woodwork, and the rest of the 60s rock music is history. Music had finally become proletarianized, or at least it appeared that way. Sure, you know, not everyone was a rock star, or not everyone could be a rock star, but the illusion that anyone could become a rock star had certainly taken root. Like anything, there was reaction to this turn of musical events. Prog rock tried to buck the trend for a while. Hey, the common man does not play in 5/8 time, nor does he want to, okay? But the punk and garage scenes, the grunge scenes, pierced through this unbecoming upper-class pretentiousness. Consequently, their Nirvana phenomenon resulted in an entire generation of young artists who could barely move beyond three-chord progressions, hence your music for the masses. And this is part of the problem when popular music or any kind of art form can be performed by anybody. Not everyone is a super talent, nor can everyone afford expensive lessons, so as a result, the art form gets dumbed down a little. Okay, sometimes a lot. Like the anti-intellectualism that runs rampant today in Western culture. Smart people are geeks, right? The ability to actually play an instrument with precision and grace is considered pompous and showy. But a funny thing happened on the way to achieving true music for the performing masses. Technology. In a former life, I wanted to desperately get into the music industry. I went to college for 3 years learning how to be a record producer and engineer. I even worked in a studio for a year. I once recorded tracks in a $1 million facility, full of all the bells and whistles you could desire. Yet, thanks to modern technology and the increasing strength of purchasing power, I actually have a fairly decent home recording studio. There's very little I can't do in the confines of my own home that I could do at a multi-million-dollar facility. And I think lots of people are getting a hint of this. I have many friends who perform and record music as hobbies, something that would have been, for cost reasons alone, completely prohibitive as little as 20 years ago. And on a related note, blogs are impacting on how people like myself are able to write and self-publish. Technology changes how art is done and by whom, and it's only going to get better. Not only will more and more people be able to afford the gadgetry of making art, but the intrinsic ability to create and perform art will be impacted as well. Thanks to the pending genomic revolution and the advent of enhancement technologies, the future will have more in store for the aspiring artist. Using genetic technologies, parents will endow their children with a whole gamut of skills and proclivities, including perfect pitch and the physical coordination required for virtuosic playing. Like the growing accessibility of musical instruments and recording technologies, musical talent will one day soon become equally attainable. Once, the masses were merely a passive audience to art as it was dictated to them. Today they have taken control of art and given it relevance. Tomorrow they will claim their own art forms and master them with all the tools at their disposal. And that will truly be music by the masses for the masses.
Come a day, you see the sun, you hit the arch, a history song.
That's all the time we have for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Look for my next podcast to appear in about a week's time, maybe less. I seem to be putting in about 1.5 episodes per week. Just as a hint to you guys, I got an email from a podcast listener, Jason, who suggests that if you're looking to listen to many, many podcasts, all you need to do is increase the speed to about 1.5 to 1.8 times. And sure, I might have a chipmunk voice, but certainly you'd be able to fit in a bit more into your busy, busy schedules, I'm sure. My goodness, what is this world coming to? Okay, some of the tracks that we heard in this episode. We started off with Clinic from their new album, Visitations, and the song was called Family. The second track was from Japanese psychedelic artists Ghost from their new album In Stormy Nights, and the track was called Motherly Bluster. The third track was from The Shins and their new album Wincing the Night Away. The track was called Sea Legs. And the last track we heard was from The Good, The Bad, and The Queen from their self-titled album, also brand new. And I'm sure you recognize that as being very... lead singer from Gorillaz. All right, everyone, have yourselves a great week. Once again, please give Keith Henson and his family a bit of a hand and head on over to Extropy Institute and give them a bit of a donation. And until next time, everyone have a great week. Bye-bye.